For the young engineer today, the future holds challenges seldom, if ever before, present. Regardless of the direction of his or her future plans and ambitions, the young engineer in modern society will do well to consider these current challenges in all their ramifications. Because of this, IEEE Soundings has asked Dr. Myron Tribus, Senior Executive Vice President of the Xerox Corporation, to discuss this important area of general interest. His associate at Xerox, David C. Allison, a member of the corporate R&D staff, interviews Dr. Tribus in this issue of Soundings.
My name's David Allison. I'm a member of the research and development staff of Xerox Corporation. And today I'm talking with my colleague Myron Tribus about the young engineer in modern society. Myron Tribus brings at least three experiences to this conversation. First, the experience of an innovative engineering educator. For a decade, he headed the Thayer School of Engineering at Dartmouth College. Second, experience in the federal government as Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Science and Technology. And third, he brings the perspective of modern industry as one of the top engineers in Xerox. Myron, let's begin with a very fundamental question. Every young engineer asks it, and it often takes him years before he gets a good answer. What is special about being an engineer?
Well, you know, Dave, that's not a new question. And when I answer it, I want to talk about what is special about being an engineer as an engineer ought to be in our society. There are important differences between what society needs from engineers and what it gets. The question has been studied and restudied for over a century in America, and it's been under study for even longer elsewhere. But the wise things that have been said in the past just simply haven't been heeded. We pay a terrible social price for not paying attention to the wise men who have spoken to us before on this subject. In a society that's based on technology, technical education is the very key to survival of that society. And that's one of the things that makes engineering very special. If a man succeeds, or a woman succeeds, as an engineer, he will play an extremely important role in our society. He will develop the new technologies, build the new factories, create the new jobs. He will stimulate concern over the social value of these new technologies. Are they good? Are they bad? The same goes for those factories and the jobs, and all the things that accompany the creation of something new. The engineer is the creator of new things in our society. He is a social agent for change. And how he thinks of himself and how he reacts to those responsibilities has a lot to do with how the society turns out. The engineer has a lever, or maybe I should say he is an amplifier. He can exert a force much greater than the force of most men, and the fact that in his exertion of that force he isn't always visible to society doesn't change the fact that he does exert the force. And how he does it, and how he exerts his influence, and how he uses his knowledge, his ability to see what is likely to be in the future, how he uses all of that depends on the self-image that he has as he gains his technical education.
If he does what you say he should do, he carries a heavy burden. He has to know more than how do I build this, or how can I build it for less money. He also has to face the question, is it worth building at all? And the question, will it contribute to social good?
Yes, he has to deal with these questions, and the answers that he brings to them may very well add to his burden as an engineer. He cannot fulfill his social obligation if he remains a narrow technical specialist. Now, he must have a sense of technical excellence. If he doesn't have this, his works will not be respected. But beyond this, he has to have the ability to think of and to see the bigger picture. And of course, the barrier to all this is his own self-image, Does he think that he has been prepared to spend a life in a narrow niche doing what he is told to do, or does he believe he has a responsibility for his works? If he takes the responsibility for his work, then he is beginning to achieve professional stature. But to achieve this stature, he really has to understand himself. In the words of the psychologist, a healthy personality is one who actively masters his environment, shows a unity of personality, and perceives the world and himself correctly. He reacts to the world as it really is, not as he wishfully thinks it is. Now, one of the things that every young engineer has to understand is that engineers do not work alone. It is unfortunate, but most classroom assignments are done on an individual basis. In engineering, organization is everything. There is no such thing as engineering without organization. There is no such thing as engineering without planning. You know, it's a pity. Engineers usually don't have the time when they're students to play football or basketball. These are places where teamwork is essential. And young men and women who want to be engineers have to learn how to be a member of a team. They have a need for self-understanding because they'll find that much of their own personal effectiveness as an engineer depends on receiving the cooperation of others. And the way they seek that cooperation has an enormous impact on whether or not they receive it. Now, I'm saying more than you know, the simple advice, understand yourself, be a nice guy, be nice to people. I'm saying that personal accomplishment in engineering only comes through others, through the ability to motivate others. And when I talk about motivation, I don't mean just subordinates, but equals and even the engineer's boss.
I can think of an example from our Xerox experience. Our new color copier is going to be introduced later this year. And as you and I know, lots of invention went into that machine. Several million dollars of research and development and engineering, and a few dozen patents covering all the work. Why don't you mention Ron Sechak's invention by way of illustrating the engineering teamwork you've been talking about?
Well, you know, Ron is an electrical engineer in our development department. And he invented a photoreceptor that we're going to use in our color machine. It is a tri-layered doped selenium photoreceptor, and it's a very important part of the machine. And as you said, Dave, his important invention was indeed a team success. Ron had the invention, but there were a couple of people who worked alongside of him who were essential. I'm thinking of Charlie Urso and Chris Snelling and Harvey Hewitt. Each of them contributed their expertise to the perfection of this invention. And then, of course, they had to deal with, say, Owen Marjama of the patent department. They had to deal with Jack Kinsella, who managed the photoreceptor manufacturing development activity. They had to deal with, say, Pete Warder and Evan Felty in the research laboratories. And there's a long, long list of names of people that he had to talk to. Now, generally, that's the way an invention is reduced to practice in a real world. You need an inventive person like Ron Sechak. And then Ron, in turn, had to be able to motivate his colleagues. He had to be able to talk to them, to help them understand what they ought to do and how they ought to do it and how their work related to others. He had to go across departmental lines. The people he worked with didn't report to his boss. He had to learn how to persuade them. You know, when that happens, everybody, the inventor, the whole organization, gets a fantastic lift. It's an enormously rewarding experience.
You're talking about leadership. The man who built our company was Joe Wilson. He spoke in terms of business leadership. But I think his words apply equally to the kind of engineering leadership you're describing. Remember, Wilson said that the head of a business works with people and that all other phases of his task pale in significance compared to his need to know human beings. He must understand the complexity of their characters and motives and persuade them of sound judgments, and above all, he said, to inspire them.
I agree. And it's unfortunate that the word management and the title manager tends to denote someone who spends his time bossing reluctant workers around. In fact, I get rather peeved at watching television. Every television show I've ever seen that shows the office situation shows the boss as a tyrant and shows him as interfering unduly in people's lives, and very seldom in the way that I have seen men in the industrial scene. The right words to use here are to lead, to inspire, to persuade. As soon as you take on the responsibility to actually accomplish something, and I want to contrast this with merely studying something or writing a report, then you have to make use of resources. And if you're an engineer in an industrial scene, the resources that you have to tap are the shops, the draftsmen, the laboratories, the sources of materials, the sources of documentation. These are things that an engineer must manage. I think it's important to distinguish between what we could call engineer X and engineer ing. Schools tend to concentrate on engineer X, and they are concerned with the logix, as in mechanics, electronics, physics, mathematics, dynamics, electromagnetics, thermodynamics, and all the other subjects that end in X. They're concerned with developing the subject in its logical context, in developing it as a complete and beautiful subject in and of itself. Now, engineering is concerned with doing, with planning, with directing, with inventing, with constructing, with servicing, with optimizing, distributing, qualifying, in short, with delivering on the promise of science and technology. The important distinction is that engineer X tends to concentrate on a noun. Engineer ing concentrates on a verb, on an active verb, because that's what engineer ing is.
In this sense, management is part of engineering, not something apart from engineering. And yet few aspiring young engineers are taught much about the art of management. Imagine yourself in that situation, Myron. If you were a young engineer now, and if you knew what you've learned from your long experience, how would you teach yourself the art of management?
Well, the first thing that a young engineer must do is to learn to manage himself. And of course, that will be the hardest challenge of all. He must learn to manage his time and his interests. Now, maybe when he's a young fellow, he feels, and it may even be true, that he can do anything, but he certainly can't do everything. It's good to work near your limit, but as a professionally responsible engineer, you cannot afford to try to go beyond that limit. You can't promise yourself or your client that you will perform beyond where you can actually perform. Now, as I said, you may be able to do anything, but you can't do everything. The days may be long enough, but they aren't wide enough to pack everything in. So learning to budget your time is the first challenge, and it isn't easy. And if you don't learn to do it, you, your family, especially your children, will ultimately suffer for it. Maybe when you're young, you can make up for inefficiency and for lack of planning by staying up late at night, but this is not a good solution for the long haul.
I think the engineering schools have a responsibility here. They pile on the work, but seldom provide coaching to help the student cope with the load.
Yeah, sometimes I think the faculty believes that the Darwinian theory of natural selection is a good philosophy, and that somehow or other the fittest will survive. But I'm not sure that the environment in the school is necessarily a good selector for those who ought to survive in engineering. I believe it shouldn't take much time in a school to run a few clinics, probably on a voluntary basis, to teach students how to manage their time. Maybe that's something that the local Tau Beta Pi chapter ought to arrange. My observation of most faculty members is, in view of the way they deal with their own time, that they don't really consider the matter as terribly important. And yet I know from professional experience that it is, and I rather wish that students were introduced to techniques of managing one's time, or just the habit of managing one's time, much earlier in life.
Another fault is that the schools too often teach that there is a specified formula or a specified answer.
Yes, they do tend to give you the feeling that there is no uncertainty in engineering. There's an overwhelming concentration in most engineering schools on engineering analysis. And while I believe that engineering analysis is terribly important, and you can't do good engineering without the ability to do engineering analysis, there are unfortunate side effects from only studying engineering analysis. After all, in analysis, what you do is to abstract a problem. You replace real transistors by mathematical models which have well-defined properties.
But in real applications?
Well, in real applications, we don't know the facts the way they appear in books. For example, if an engineer quotes the breakdown voltage of a diode in the inverse direction by giving only one number, he commits a dangerous error. If he really wants to tell people what he knows, he has to quote a probability distribution, because as those diodes come off the assembly line, they are not identical. In today's world, where we are so much concerned with the consumer, and where we are involved in mass production, we must be concerned not only with how the average machine performs, but also the one in a thousand. That means when we're dealing with a design, we must do a sensitivity analysis, we must do statistical analyses, we must do risk analyses, we must do decision analyses. In general, we must take into account the fact that while we do know something, we don't know everything, and it is just immoral to pretend that we're omniscient, that we really know all the facts when we don't. And it is this emphasis in the schools on textbook-type problems in which all of the facts are known that builds into the engineer the feeling that he must pretend to know even when he doesn't.
What about risks, taking chances? How good is engineering education in this regard in preparing the young engineer to face uncertainty?
Well, I think engineering students believe they're being trained to make choices, and that's unfortunate. Actually, they must learn to take chances. But the chances they take must be taken openly, not in secret. The organization and the engineer in it have to learn to take their chances together, to face uncertainty together. And they mustn't sweep uncertainty under the rug. They have to make it part of every communication. For example, an engineering report, maybe done in combination with the marketing section, might say something like this: we expect the new model widget will cost $3.20, and that we'll sell about 27,000 next year at a price of $6. And you can multiply all that together and discover that there's a very tidy profit in it. But in truth, the cost estimate is only good to maybe 10 or 20% at this early stage. The sales estimate is only good to maybe plus or minus 30%, and the price could easily be pushed down by competition to about $4.50. So the profit on a transaction like this could swing from anywhere from $75,000 down to $18,000. A responsible engineer knows this, but a beginning engineer doesn't. He doesn't realize that it's important that we discuss the problem, including our uncertainty, including the things we don't know. And therefore, I think the schools ought to include in the students' experiences an opportunity to deal with this uncertainty and the need to exercise judgment with respect to the uncertainty.
Well, let's take that engineer and that uncertainty, and supposing he has a boss who's not an engineer, what's he tell his boss? The boss wants to know, will the building be finished on time, or how long is it going to take to issue the drawings? Will the new device be reliable? And if not, how much is it going to cost to hold back production?
Well, Dave, when you are uncertain, you do have a very difficult personal problem. You have the question of how you appear to your boss and what your boss is going to do. You want to appear certain because that gives the boss confidence in you. At the same time, you don't want him to act as though you really knew what you were talking about when you don't. That's not a trivial problem. I've seen it in industry quite often. You know, they laugh at Sam Goldwyn for saying, "I'll give you a definite maybe." But Sam Goldwyn didn't get where he did by being foolish. So the sooner that the engineer and his organization learn to face uncertainty and incomplete knowledge openly and honestly, the sooner they learn to do that, the better. This means they'll have to learn to express their knowledge in probability language. They'll have to learn to accept the notion that a man asked to take a risk must be dealing with the unknown and can't pretend that he knows more than he really does without leading a lot of people astray. That means the engineer and his boss just have to accept the fact that there is imperfection in the world. I can only offer two pieces of advice here. First, learn this as quickly as you possibly can. Once you've learned it, it will save you years of anguish, because there's nothing worse than feeling that somehow or other you should have been perfect when perfectibility was impossible. Secondly, I think you ought to study the lives of other people that have learned to cope with their own limitations and rise above them. I think that if you study the life and style of Harry Truman, you can begin to understand this. He, after all, truly understood himself. He faced his own limitations squarely. He achieved about as much as any of us would ever dream of achieving. And, you know, if you're lucky, you'll be surrounded by people whose abilities will make up for your shortcomings. Now, if you're smart and you're lucky, then that combination will allow your own growth to be nurtured.
There's a statement in the preface of a book that every young engineer should know. The author was Jack Morton of Bell Labs, an engineer of considerable professional achievement himself. Morton says in that preface that the people of the Bell system, my associates, subordinates, and bosses have taught me, challenged me, stimulated me to grow almost in spite of myself. I, for one, am convinced, Morton said, that a man can play over his head indefinitely if he has the good fortune to be immersed in a vigorous and adaptive enterprise, an enterprise that has a challenging mission and a dedication to technological and organizational innovation.
Well, I think that's excellent advice. When the young engineer goes after his first job, he should not be fooled by looking only at the salary offers. Today, salaries tend to be rather similar from company to company, and 10 or 15% one way or the other doesn't really make that much difference. What the engineer should look at is the caliber of the men who will be his bosses and his colleagues.
Morton would agree.
I know so many engineers of stature who look back at their earliest supervisors with fond gratitude. Remember, at the beginning of a career, the most important pay shows up in an increase in intellectual capital. That kind of capital pays handsome dividends, and it's not subject to tax. I believe that if the young engineer can find a really dynamic, competent group within which to work, he will play over his head for a long time. And after a while, he will develop the kind of competence that he could never get when surrounded by people of just ordinary capabilities.
Many professional people are pretty parochial. Engineers are no exception to this. I'm talking about the what would they do without us syndrome.
Oh, yes. I saw that in Washington. I saw that in attorneys, in scientists, in engineers, doctors, economists. Engineers aren't the only people who get this self-glorified perspective of the world. And it's an easy trap into which to fall. It's a certain internal pleasure you get out of telling everybody how important you are by explaining how it is your profession really controls the country. You know, when I was a boy and I lived on a farm, I used to hear the farmers say, "Why, if we farmers stopped, the whole country would starve in 30 days. And they were probably right. Because in a complex, interdependent society, a lot of people can bring things to a halt. The garbage collectors, the mailman, you name it. Any group that decides to go on strike and stop can stop everything. It takes a lot of collaboration to make things go. It takes real professional skill to make men build together. To destroy is very easy."
There's also the view that says those of us in this profession really understand the world, and people of other professions have little or nothing to contribute.
Well, that's a terribly narrow view of things. If you think about any significant engineering accomplishment, it doesn't take very long to realize that that accomplishment would have been impossible without the collaboration of most of the other professions. For example, the Bay Area Rapid Transit System in San Francisco Bay, or ComSat, the satellite organization, or the jumbo jets, or even a nuclear power plant, if you consider any of these, you realize that to put them in place takes the combined efforts of engineers, politicians, attorneys, financiers, workers, union representatives, just to name a few. They had to pool their knowledge. Each of them had to play their part, and then they had to combine to deal with the really big questions associated with these projects. In each case, they were questions such as, why are we doing this? Is it worth the cost? Who will be affected? Will it really be good for us and our children? Is the way we're doing it building a difficulty for tomorrow? These big questions have to be dealt with, and they can't be dealt with from the perspective of any one of the professions. People in professions have to learn to work together. And for any one of them to presume that somehow or other it has the key to all the answers and all other professions are subservient, or for any one of them to take that point of view, is ridiculous. And when I meet a man from a profession who does take that point of view, I know that he is not very well educated.
And there's the irony, because these are some of the very subjects that many young people who are in engineering school are hoping to avoid. I mean the humanities and social sciences. When you get involved with the question, is it worth the cost, you're dealing with questions of human values. And I know lots of engineers who hate to be confronted with questions like that.
Well, you are right, and I said as we started to talk that I'm concerned with things as they ought to be, not with things as they are today. And I've concluded, and I think it's easy looking at the world around us to conclude that we cannot go on as we have. Just look at the frightful mess that started to emerge as the environmental and the energy policies of the country come into conflict. The Clean Air Act forced much too rapid a decrease in effluents from our automobiles, so that the fuel consumption of new cars went up by about 30%. But at the same time, we have a fuel shortage. Now, both of these results were predicted, they were predictable, and they were predicted. But the engineers were on tap. They were not on top, and their voices simply weren't heard.
Why were they not heard? Why aren't engineers on top? I think it's because many engineers don't want to be on top. They want to follow.
Well, I think you're right. In my view, it's because the processes of self-selection that bring a young man or a young woman into the engineering school are reinforced by the image held out to them by the faculty, the curriculum, and the environment. You know, the dropout rate from engineering has always been large. It's an untold secret that the dropout from the top of the class has always been as great as the dropout from the bottom. As many students have left because they found the work intellectually confining as because they found it too demanding. The result has been an extreme shortage of men whose self-image and interests would have led them to the top.
You've reached the end of side one. To continue, stop your cassette player, turn over the cassette and restart your machine.